House members who are joining us today for the very important May revenue forecast, always a memorable day in the session. And according to history and tradition, on this day, the weather is important. If it's raining outside, that means the forecast will forecast sunnier days ahead. So let's see. It is raining. It is raining outside. So let's call Josh and Mark up here for our sunny forecast.
So it's ground revenue day, right?
Yeah. Is it on the loose already?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, and joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner to give the quarterly economic and revenue forecast. So as the April personal income tax filing season is winding down, it's become apparent that we've had a good year. Revenues aren't growing as fast as they were a couple years ago, but nevertheless, Oregon is still seeing relatively rapid gains compared to other states. We're among the fastest growing states in terms of our state tax revenue, along with a lot of our western neighbors with us. And so it's put us in a different position than most states. The typical state right now is looking at a large majority of states are finding their collections not adding up to what they planned during the budget process, so facing shortfalls in the near term, where Oregon, we're in a different position, having more revenue than we had expected in the March forecast, and as a result, we're getting to the point where we trigger our unique kicker law. So what's difficult about having a good April right now is it's difficult to reconcile given what we're seeing in the economic data. Since we met last quarter, a lot of the economic data in Oregon has slowed. I want to make sure to say it's not that Oregon's shrinking. It's not that our economy is becoming smaller or anything like that. We're still bigger than we've ever been and still growing. So it feels there's a lot of traffic out there, and there's low unemployment and things like that. So it certainly we're still operating in a healthy economy by all means. But the growth rate of the economy is starting to slow down. And we saw that in the tax returns. And more vitally, we're really starting to see it in the employment data, where the jobs data in Oregon and the job growth is starting to converge to what we're seeing in other states. So the first chart I've prepared compares employment job growth in Oregon relative to the U.S. average. And during this business cycle, as is always the case, Oregon's traditional advantage came back. And as of a year ago, we were adding jobs at about twice the national rate. But in the recent months, that's come down, as you see here, quite quickly, where now in Oregon we're growing at about a 2% a year, which is not that different from the U.S. average. And this has been really broad-based, we'll point out, across industries and across regions of the state. And although it was really built into the outlook, we expected once we got to the point where labor markets were tight and we were in a mature expansion and it was hard to find workers, that the speed of the recovery would slow down, largely because as you're coming right out of a recession and digging out of a hole, we're bringing workers off of the sidelines and can really sustain some pretty exceptional rates of growth. But those times are over, and so we have to transition down to something a little more sustainable. But that transition over the last couple months has been pretty alarmingly fast. That said, here in an hour or two, the Employment Department will release the April jobs. That should improve things somewhat, but nevertheless, the trend will still be here. We'll still be looking at a really broad-based deceleration in job gains.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And as Mark was saying, the slowdown we're seeing in job growth here in the state of Oregon is really widespread. It's really pervasive. And so we're just trying to look and get a handle for, you know, was it just one particular sector that took a hit? You know, the manufacturing sector with the strong U.S. dollar that we've talked about in recent quarters and things like that. And that's not the case. While we're seeing slowing in manufacturing and even some job losses, this slowdown is really across two-thirds of the different industries here in the state of Oregon. What this chart shows you here in the dark blue line is in recent years, roughly one-third of these detailed industries across the state of Oregon were seeing slower job gains. That means two-thirds of industries were seeing the same type of job growth or faster job growth than they had seen the year prior. Well, certainly over the last 12, 18 months, that has flipped. And so now two-thirds of Oregon's industries are slowing down. They're still adding jobs. 70 to 80% of these industries are still adding jobs, which is great, but it's just at a slower pace than they have in recent years. And so we're seeing it really widespread again. It's not one sector or one industry specific. Really, the only big sector that's still adding jobs at a steady rate or a faster rate is construction. And as the housing recovery continues to ramp up, although ramp up is probably the wrong word, it's more of a slow and steady recovery in fits and starts over the recent years. Construction is still adding jobs at a healthy clip. The same cannot be said necessarily for the other industries.
And unfortunately, the slowdown is broad-based across regions as well as across the industries that Josh just mentioned. Here we see growth in three different groupings: the Portland metropolitan area, our secondary metropolitan areas, and everything else, non-metro or rural Oregon. And as you see here, they've all slowed in recent months. And again, things are still in a healthy situation when we look at across the state. Every region of the state, even the most rural, have added a few jobs at least over the last year. But that said, that pace of additions has slowed just about everywhere. So far, the only place that's really immune to this slowdown is down in the southern corner of the state. Josephine, Jackson, Klamath County, so far haven't seen anything there. But everywhere else, it's starting to be a little bit more of a depressing story, in particular in the Portland metropolitan area. You see here, Portland slowed down to your sub 2% rates, closer to 1% growth year over year, which is really unheard of for the fast-growing Portland area. Unless you're coming into or going out of a recession, Portland doesn't see this slow growth rate. The last time we saw something like this was in the Asian financial crisis, and it's particularly pronounced in Multnomah County, where job gains have been really flat in recent months. So hopefully this won't be too much of it. You know, this is an issue. It would be more troublesome if we saw this kind of broad-based slowing at the U.S. level, which we haven't yet, as long as the U.S. continues to crank along. So too will Oregon, but it does appear that our growth advantage is eroding here as we get into a late mature expansion. But there are good things that happen with a mature expansion, particularly in terms of the labor force and the labor supply.
That's right. Job growth is slowing, but it's largely for a good reason, because we've brought all these workers off the sidelines. They found jobs. The unemployment rate is down. We still have a lower labor force participation rate, probably relative to what it should be if we had a strong economy for an extended period of time, right? The economy has been underperforming for the vast majority of the last 17 years. And so, therefore, we've lost some participation gains. But as long as the expansion continues and we continue to see job growth, we're expecting to see some of those participation gains, you know, play out. We'll get some more of those workers back in. And the other thing it's doing is it's really having firms cast a wider net to hire and fill vacant positions, because a lot of people already have a job, so it's hard to find available workers. And so you have to dig a little bit deeper into that resume stack when you're looking to fill a position. And so what that means is you're taking people that maybe have an incomplete skill set, or maybe they've been out of work, long-term unemployed for a while. Maybe they're working on a career transition because they lost their job in one industry and they're retraining to find another one. These sort of things, these sort of mismatches in the economy, maybe more of a structural or cyclical type of unemployment takes a while to play out, and you really only start to see these improvements in the later mature business cycles as the economy starts to reach full employment. And what this chart here, it's a little complicated, is trying to show is we're starting to see job employment rates really pick up for middle-aged Oregonians. What this does is look at the share of the population that has a job, the employment-to-population ratio, today relative to 2007, where we were prior to the Great Recession. So as these lines are right around zero, that means the same share of the population today has a job as the share of the population had a job back in 2007. The light gray line there that says 2005, this is something we talked about a couple years ago here in the committee, is the young Oregonians, the 25, 35-year-old millennials, had their jobs come back first. They were some of the first employees hired coming out of the Great Recession. And then older Oregonians, 50, 60, 70-year-old Oregonians, were working at a larger degree than they had before as well. Some of that's for financial reasons. They don't have the retirement nest eggs and the savings that they need to be able to sustain themselves in retirement. So they had to work later in life. Some of it's also the shifting nature of work. We have more office jobs, less physical labor today in the economy than we used to, so people can work later in life should they choose to at a higher rate than previously. But what was missing was really the 40 and 50-year-old Oregonians were seeing substantially lower employment rates, right? Again, the jobs came back first for the young workers, and the older workers were staying in their careers longer than they had previously. But that has switched in the last couple of years. The middle-aged Oregonians now have the same employment rates today as they did a decade ago, right? And so some of that has to do, again, with the tightening business cycle where firms are hiring from a wider swath of the population. And we're also seeing it turn around for the long-term unemployed, which would fit this narrative as well. Some of these 40 and 50-year-olds, maybe they lost their job during the recession. They couldn't find one, maybe because of those mismatches between skills or geographic location of jobs, or maybe potentially due to some age discrimination in the hiring practices. But today, in a tight economy, that is no longer evident in the data. And we've started to get the share of the population with the job all the way back to where it was a year ago. And overall, that's a good news. So right now, we're seeing the slower job growth across the state. We're starting to hit the sweet spot. We're starting to see really good numbers coming out of wages and household incomes and the employment rates and what have you. But that means there's certainly still risk to the outlook. And something we went over 3 months ago with the committee was kind of detailing some of these federal policy risks that are kind of looming large. We don't have a lot of clarity regarding specific policies coming from the federal government. There's been a lot of things discussed, some of which would kind of have an average-sized impact here in the state of Oregon, and some of which would have an outsized impact here in the state of Oregon, given our concentration in certain industries or certain professions, or our trading patterns with countries around the globe. And so this still remains a risk. There have not been a lot of clarity within the last 3 months, even regarding maybe healthcare legislation, which looked like it was dead for a while but then came back and has passed the U.S. House and the Congress. We still don't have a lot of detail necessarily on what federal healthcare policy will look like moving forward. And such, this remains a risk to the outlook.
Yeah, one of them for this committee that we wanted to highlight, we talked a little bit last time about the timber industry and the Affordable Care Act and trade wars and the like, but the tax base broadening, that's something we're not sure that's going to come out of the federal legislation, or if it's just going to be rate cuts or no reform at all. But it just bears mentioning with this group because most of Oregon taxes, our starting point is federal taxable income for corporations and individuals. And so when they broaden the base, they get rid of credits, deductions, subtractions, things like that, it creates a higher starting point for Oregon income or Oregon tax calculations. And so in the 80s when we saw big reforms like this, this created a windfall of revenue for Oregon. Some of the things they're discussing now could have similar impact. Of course, with the interaction with our unique kicker law, those things will not be built in, and so depending on how big it is, it may run into some issues with that. But in general, before we move on to the revenue outlook, we are seeing this slowdown come to pass. So for the economic, the baseline economic outlook isn't changed very much. We've lowered employment growth a little bit in the near term in keeping with just how weak the numbers have been in the last couple of months. But in general, the qualitative outlook is really the same. And here you see it in terms of thousands of jobs a month. Oregon was adding 4,000 or 5,000 jobs a month during the peak of the recovery. We expect that to transition down to something more along the lines of our underlying population and labor force gains, which would be 2,000 to 3,000 jobs a month. The most recent quarters have been even south of that. But we do expect some rebound here in the near term as we go forward. But so continued employment gains, just not like what we've become accustomed to in the past couple of years and in recent economic expansions. Unfortunately, the slowdown in economic data isn't just isolated to the employment numbers. We're also seeing it in terms of income growth. These are some preliminary numbers we're getting out of the most recent filing season, so 2016 tax year, the returns that people turned in this April. We're starting to tally those, and it does not look good relative to recent years. You see here, overall income growth has slowed down by about half, been cut by about half in the last 2 years in Oregon. And that's really been broad-based across all sorts of income types, business income, retirement income, labor income, investment income. Really everything has taken a step back, with the exception of interest payments. As we've seen interest rates go up slightly, we've finally seen a little bounce back to that. But as you see here, 5% growth in interest payments is still not a significant number, given we're starting so low. 105% of zero is still pretty much zero right now. But if we do get to a normalized interest rate environment, that becomes a significant revenue item as well. But now we have seen a slowdown, and this again is based on 2016 activity. So this is a little bit backward looking, and that's what becomes difficult to reconcile when we're looking at the slowdown in economic activity relative to some pretty strong recent revenue numbers. So to what extent is it indicative of a healthier economy, of a bigger economy, or more firms, or a better outlook for the future? And to what extent is it just shifting around time? We often choose which year to realize our taxable events. Some of our investment income or our business income and the like, taxpayers are flexible and shift over time. And so sometimes when we see a big April season, it just means that there will be less available in future years. So it really becomes a balance to try to figure out how much is just a timing and temporary issue, and to what extent do these returns mean we're going to have better growth in the future and maybe offset some of the slowing that we're seeing in the economic numbers? So far, it looks like the personal income tax numbers are the most timely ones we have, which are withholdings out of paychecks, are looking a lot like the labor income was, or the jobs data we just looked at. That is, over the last our half year or so, we've seen a ramp down. Now, withholding here is very noisy, very volatile, but for most of the most recent years, we've been hovering somewhere between 7-10% in terms of our year-over-year withholding growth. Now we've shifted down in more like the 5-7% range. Still very strong relative to other states. That would still put us in the fives and sixes. We'd still be among the top performing states out there in terms of growth, but definitely a shift down from where we've been. So that one is relatively easy insofar as the withholding income and the labor income tends to track pretty well and right along the lines of the economic variables in the economy that we're looking at. What can be more difficult are investment-type incomes and business incomes that are often paid at the end of the year in April, and that's what we've just collected recently and are just it's just starting to clear up in terms of where we're going to land for the filing season. So the next chart shows April payments or year-end payments of personal income tax, and as they've accumulated over the filing season to date. And it's a very frustrating process because in April and May, here we are in the middle of May, there's still some uncertainty there as the numbers, as they go through the pile of returns at the Department of Revenue. And so it's particularly hard when people are most concerned in April to really know. Here you see the red line would be our path this year. Relative to past years, the closest the dark blue line there is last year, 2016. We've seen significant growth over 2016. A lot of that had to do with the fact that we paid a kicker out in 2016, and so the growth rates are a little bit inflated. But nevertheless, it's been a healthy year. As you see here, we're on track for a record level, and if we slow down, it looks like we'll be somewhere around where the forecast was. But again, very, very noisy. At March 1st, it looked like we were down 11% from last year in terms of our payments. By May 1st, we were up 34% relative to the year before. And that's May 1st is when we did our last conference call with the folks who do our job in other states. And most at that point were seeing flat returns, you know, in the U.S. level, at the federal level, we were seeing real flat year over year. And so we expected it to become more normal, but nevertheless, it looks like we still will see some pretty significant growth along the lines of what we were expecting. What hasn't been along the lines of what we were expecting is the other side of the equation in April, which are refunds paid out. Refunds paid out tend to go out the door earlier than the return, so we have a little bit better idea of where they're going to land. This year they were delayed, as you see, till February 15th because of the federal delays in processing. But nevertheless, we're not going to get to the same level of refunds or payments that we got to last year, and we'll end up significantly short of the forecast. And so this is what's driving our surplus revenue in this cycle. It's largely coming out of these refunds, and so part of this is we're going to go ahead we've made some changes to the model to reflect this. It's over time. It seems that Oregonians have been getting cutting it closer in terms of their tax payments. That is paying closer to what they owe. Traditionally, taxpayers, whether it's rational or not, tend to like to get refunds, and they like to, even though an economist would tell you people want to hold their own money as long as they can. That's in practice. That's not the way a lot of filers like it. They like to have, or traditionally have liked to have, some pretty fat refunds in Oregon. Well, in recent years, that's gone away, and part of it, the thinking was that it was cyclical, that as we're coming out of recession and people have unexpected income growth and things are starting to get better faster than they thought, they end up having faster income growth than they estimated, and therefore haven't paid enough taxes and get smaller refunds. But now that we're getting into the mature cycle, we really haven't seen these refunds bounce back in terms of what share of overall labor income or what share of total tax payments or the like. They're still relatively low. So we've gone ahead and incorporated a lower refund share going forward in the outlook. But nevertheless, that has, you know, created the surplus in this tax year, which is bringing us right up against the threshold for our unique kicker law. And so we're going to take a little aside now. We have some new members to talk about the mechanics of the kicker law and how that's going to work.
Sorry, a little background on exactly how the kicker is calculated and how exactly it would work. And the graph you see in front of you is looking at the personal income tax kicker. And what the personal income tax kicker is a little bit of a misnomer. It's the total general fund minus corporate taxes. So it includes the state taxes, the cigarettes, criminal fines and fees and things like that, in addition to personal income tax as well. And so what the kicker base is, the light blue bar on the left, is our May 2015 forecast. So when we were in front of you 2 years ago to this day, plus any legislative changes that were made during the 2015 session as scored by Legislative Revenue Office. So it's our May forecast from 2 years ago plus LRO impact statements from legislation. That's the kicker base. From there, you calculate 2% of that above that, and that's the red bar. The 2% threshold is $338 million of that previous kicker base. If our forecast at the end of the biennium, or the actual revenues coming in at the end of the biennium, is more than 2% above that kicker base calculation, the whole entire amount over the kicker base is returned to taxpayers, right? So right now, with our May 2017 forecast, we're now projecting the kicker base calculation for 2015-17 to be $69.9 million above that 2% threshold, for a total of $407.8 million, which is 2.4%. So we're really cutting it close right now in terms of where the forecast is, where we think revenues will come in over the next 2 months to close out the biennium, and where the threshold of 2% is. And now, in terms of where this money will go, it'll come out in tax returns next year. Should the kicker come to pass, if our projections are reasonably accurate over the next 2 months, then we'll pay it out next year in the form of a credit on taxes filed next April. And so Oregonian taxpayers will either get a larger refund, or they'll have a smaller final payment when they calculate their taxes next April. In terms of how we're going to pay it out and who gets it, well, we pay the kicker out in the same way that we take the money in. It's proportionate to your income, and so therefore, higher income households get a larger kicker check. This is just an update of a chart we've shown before in our previous kicker round, right, where the median household, the median taxpayer, the median tax filer in the state of Oregon is looking at about $85 on their tax return next year. The average is significantly above that, more like $200, $210 per household. And as you go up the income ladder, that number gets larger again because we pay it out in the same way that we take it in. So the more income you make, the larger your kicker check is in absolute dollars, but because of that, your income's larger in absolute terms as well. In terms of any sort of economic impact of this shot of sort of disposable income to the economy, right, these people are going to be getting a little bit more money in April next year than maybe they had been planning on. You can kind of look at some survey results and some academic analysis of what you would call the marginal propensity to consume. If somebody gave you $20 today, how much of that would you go spend? Would you just go buy lunch? Would you spend all of it? Would you save it? You know, that sort of thing. And you find out that the further you go up the income spectrum, the larger the marginal propensity to consume is, because, you know, people higher up have a larger nest egg. They have a larger you know, they're not living paycheck to paycheck, and so therefore they don't spend as much of it immediately. And so overall, when you factor in the income distribution of how we're going to pay out the personal income tax kicker, we're talking about 15% of it will be spent pretty much immediately as some sort of short-term boost to the economy. So overall, it's not a big deal. We're not building that sort of economic impact of spending 15% of $400 million over the course of the middle of next year.
But in general, yeah, this really does highlight, Oregon's unique tax system that you guys are coming up against. In fact, you know, it's difficult because Oregon's in a position where we have pretty proportional taxes compared to other states. No state has a real progressive tax system where you tax high-income households more at a higher rate than you do low-income tax households, or as a higher share of their income. But Oregon is about as far as they get in terms of being pretty flat, or pretty proportional, where high-income households pay about the same amount as low-income households. And as you wrestle with reform, it becomes difficult to really move away from our income tax structure, because moving away from income tax almost certainly harms in terms of equity. But as Josh said, the kicker is not a certainty yet. So this is a little bit maddening for this forecast, because we're coming up to the very end of the biennium. We only have a few weeks left, but we're still not 100% sure, and not even close to 100% sure that we will actually have a kicker. Here we are looking at forecast errors from the May forecast until the end of the biennium, adjusted for the size of the economy back in the back years. So as you see here, it's not out of the question that we would see revenues come in $70 million below what we expect over this last 6 weeks, and in which case the kicker would no longer be triggered. There's still quite a bit of uncertainty, even though we have both of our tax seasons really behind us for the most part. If we were to assume that our forecast errors are normally distributed follow a bell curve, in that case, which is a dubious assumption, but nevertheless, if our errors are in a bell curve, that would mean we have about a 2/3 chance of having this kicker be realized and a 1/3 chance of it not existing. So one in three is a pretty good chance that this thing will be turned off. And so as uncomfortable as it would have been, you know, waiting so long, if we'd have waited to until next forecast to first show a kicker, that, you know, would be painful. But there's also pain here if it does end up coming in below $70 million and turning the kicker off, insofar as it's been built into the baseline, particularly for 2017-2018, we've pulled this $400 million out of taxpayers' payments and in terms of their bigger refunds, and so if the kicker is not realized, it makes it very highly likely that we'll have a kicker in the 2017-2019 biennium. In absence of a recession, given that we have lowered that forecast by $400 million as this one goes out. In terms of what's driving the kicker, of course, personal income tax, which is 80% of our combined revenues, is the major driver, being $300 million over forecast. But relative to its size, that's about half of the forecast error. But it's far more than half of the forecast. The really problematic ones over this last biennium have been lottery and estate taxes, particularly estate taxes. The last few times I've come up here, we've been talking about our surprise estate taxes. Last year was a record. This year looks like not double, but darn near double what we saw last year in terms of estate tax collections. Here's a look at our monthly collections, and as well as the red line being a 12-month average. You see here we've gone from, in recent years, somewhere every month getting $7-10 million a month out of our estate taxes. But in the last year, that's ramped up to $15-17 a month, $1 million a month, excuse me. Pretty impressive, with a couple of very large monthly events in there at $40-45 million a month. And so this $110-111 million increase in the estate tax forecast ate up about a third of our room in terms of the kicker law. The question is, how much of this is going to continue to go in the future? We talked to our advisors about this, and there are a couple of things working in opposite directions in terms of estate taxes. One being, we got a lot of retirees out there. We've seen a lot of wealth here, stock prices, home prices up, and so this would suggest quite a lot of estate taxes. But this is being offset to some extent by tax planning. It's very easy to avoid estate taxes. You don't even have to typically move to Washington or move out of state to do it. You can gift a lot of your money away, and so a lot of advisors are doing that. However, we may be over making a little bit too much of that. There's a much bigger incentive to avoid estate taxes at the federal level, which is at a higher threshold. It's at $5 million and 40%. So, moving to a gift tax for that might be reasonable. But when you're talking about a $1 million threshold at 10% for Oregon, it's less of a sure thing. And so there may be quite a bit more big years ahead of us for estate taxes, but that's not certain yet. One aside, unfortunately, I pulled an old slide here out of our slide deck. I will update it on our website today. The newer slide, we have bumped up estate taxes a little bit in the future there. The forecast of those gray bars will look a lot more like home prices now in the current outlook, and I'll go ahead and update that today. But I apologize, I pulled an old slide for this one. In addition to estate taxes, another one that has a lot of uncertainty right now, both in the recent past and the near future, are lottery revenues.
Lottery sales continue to boom, relatively speaking, where we've been in recent years, right? Coming out of the Great Recession, consumers were holding on to their income. They weren't spending it on very discretionary forms of spending, gaming being very discretionary itself in terms of the hierarchy of needs of a household budget. But in the last couple of years, lottery sales, gaming revenue across the country has started to boom again. Some of that had to do locally with the implementation of new video lottery machines, video lottery terminals across the state. All the machines you see at your bars and restaurants are currently being replaced. They're about halfway through that process, maybe a little over halfway through that process right now, and we'll continue to finish that over the next year to 2 years. And so we've seen an uptick in this revenue growth, and right now we're at an all-time high in terms of where we are in lottery proceeds. And the one large item that looms in the uncertainty is the impact of the LNA casino up in La Center, Washington. Right now, we have a large impact associated with that casino built into our forecast. We put it in over the course of the last year. We're talking on the neighborhood of $100 million a year in sales, $70 million a year in transfers, about what available resources to the state for budgeting purposes. The casino's been open for 3 weeks. And we have not seen any impact in the statewide lottery numbers, which is a surprise. Now, the research team at Lottery has done a lot of good work looking at individual retailers. They're seeing some impact on Hayden Island, as you would expect. They're seeing some declines relative to where they were a year ago. But beyond that, the sales in the rest of the state outside of that very northern part of the Portland metropolitan area are more than enough to offset the weaknesses we're seeing there. So I think that means the uncertainty regarding the lottery forecast is to the upside right now, that the casino impact we have built in is too large. Now, it's still way too early to know for sure. Again, 3 weeks of weekly sales reports does not give a clear picture of the types of impact that we're going to see, particularly when it comes to some discretionary forms of spending like gaming. Sometimes people will have a set budget of how much money they're going to spend on gaming. If you go to the casino and you spend it all in one fell swoop over the course of an afternoon, that means you'll have less money to spend the rest of the month. So you might not see this impact. This impact in terms of the sales might be delayed a little bit, but over the course of the coming months and in the coming biennium, we'll certainly revisit these estimates and adjust accordingly. But I think I said it again, after 3 weeks, it's fair to say the risk is tilted towards the upside. And we're not adjusting that casino impact yet, given the process of leading up to this forecast. The casino was just opening as we were spinning the models, and again, 3 weeks is too early to tell, but that's certainly an upside risk to lottery revenues over the short term.
So although it's not in the general fund, we agreed this time to go ahead and put together some numbers for marijuana revenues as well. And in our report, there's a new distributions table in the back. Our role in doing this, it may be formalized. There's a Senate bill right now that would hand the responsibility for this over to our agency permanently. What we bring to the process is really the process here in terms of forecasting this. Even if we had expertise, we don't have a lot of data yet. And so what we tried to do, the way we do the highway cost or the lottery forecast or the like, or the prison population and whatnot, is to really try to have a transparent process, bring in stakeholders and the like, and try to come up with something that most of us can be comfortable with in terms of state planning. So we did that. We got some people from the private sector and an army of folks from the different agencies that touch on marijuana in some ways, as well as some stakeholders to come together and meet this month to hash out what we're going to do for an outlook. And for now, it's mostly leaning on what we've seen in Colorado and Washington.
As Mark was saying, you know, we have basically just over a year's worth of data in terms of recreational marijuana sales. Now, that year of data that we have is very convoluted and complex because we were starting with the early sale starts at medical dispensaries at 25% tax rate. Now we're at OLCC licensed retailers at a 17% tax rate, and there's a transition period where you had both operated in the same market. We had some supply issues where Mother Nature wasn't cooperating with the outdoor harvest, and that restricted supply on the in the retailers. And there's a lot of things going on, but we still have a year of data, which a year of data is better than no data. And so when it comes to estimating and forecasting these revenues, we have a much better starting point than, say, the price tag committee for Measure 91 did a couple years ago when they had no data. And so what we're doing here, as Mark was saying, is we're really relying on some of our counterparts in other states in terms of the trends that they're seeing. We spoke with both our counterparts in Washington and Colorado to discuss some of this, along with the other agencies and stakeholders here within Oregon. And we're really looking towards the trends they've seen in their initial years to peg the short-term forecast. Over time, as the market matures, Oregon recreational marijuana market should transition to some sort of consumer spending outlook, population growth, consumer spending, once we get to that mature market. We're not there right now. It'll be a few years, certainly, before this ramp-up period is over. You may notice here what this chart tries to do is look at our sales base, the amount of monthly sales we're seeing here in Oregon, compared to those first couple years in Colorado and Washington, but then adjusting for their population size, because both states are larger than ours, so they should see more sales than us just on a demographic or economic size population basis. And so we just adjusted theirs down to our level. You can see Oregon had a really strong year, the first year of sales, equivalent to Colorado and significantly outpacing Washington. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is we had a lot of cross-border activity with Washington early on. We had a built-in customer base, so to speak. So therefore, when we turned the switch on here in Oregon, a lot of those sales that were occurring in Southwest Washington just switched to being on this side of the river where most of those people live to begin with. And so therefore, that sort of propped up those initial sales relative to what we're seeing. The other one that we saw in other states is they were really supply constrained in terms of the number of retailers and large population centers, right? In Colorado, Denver had a bunch of retailers initially, but say Boulder did not. It took a while for Boulder to come online. So as you added retailers to the Boulder market, sales increased because of access to the product. Yeah. In Washington, I think they started out with two or three retailers in Seattle initially, right? So they were severely under-retailed in Seattle when they first started the recreational program up north. And so as they added more stores to Seattle, we saw Seattle growth really take off. I don't think that's the case here in Oregon today. Portland and Eugene in particular seem to have a number of stores. They don't, not that there can't be more room for growth and more stores in the future in a growing market. However, I don't believe they were severely constrained on the number of retail outlets initially. And so therefore, maybe that's some of that ramp up growth in the first couple of years that we saw in Colorado and Washington doesn't apply to us for that very reason, that it's a demographic product availability standpoint. And so that has a lot to do with where we have our growth over the next 2 years. It's very strong. It's just maybe not quite as strong as what we saw in Colorado and Washington. When it comes to the amount of available money to spend in terms of financing OHA and financing schools and the state police and what have you, there's a couple of interesting or budgetary nuggets to decipher here. And the first one is there's a time lag between when the money's collected Department of Revenue and when the legislature and the agencies can actually spend the money. It comes in. Retailers pay on a monthly basis, but it's not until they file their quarterly tax return every 3 months that then the Department of Revenue processes that. They true it up. They figure out how much revenue there actually should be and calculate that, and then it gets distributed. So that time lag between when things start to pile up at Department of Revenue versus when it becomes available to spend on the agencies and the programs that receive distributions from it can be anywhere, between 3 to 6 months, 1 or 2 quarter time lag. And so in this ramp-up period, sales are going to outpace distributions for a number of years. And so while we have sales, nearly triple in the 2017-19 forecast, we have sales nearly triple what the outlook was initially when Measure 91 was passed by the voters. The amount of available distributions is more like 2 times what it was then, or 2.5 times what it was then, because of this time lag between when the money becomes available for transfers. And so we're talking about $156 million in available resources for 2017-19 when it comes to recreational marijuana revenues. The governor's recommended budget had 117 built in. I believe the initial Measure 91 impact statement had more like $59 or $69 million built into it. So again, it's considerably more money than we had or we thought we had a couple years ago regarding this outlook. However, it's still relatively small in the size of the state budget.
You know, the stakeholders were, for the most part, comfortable with ramping up the revenue outlook for marijuana revenues. They did articulate risk, and the biggest risk that people are worried about is pricing. We really haven't seen what the floor in pricing is yet in Colorado or Washington, just some pretty steady declines. The declines have slowed, but nevertheless, even in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, we've all seen persistent declines in price since legalization. So depending on where that bottom is, that could certainly erode our tax revenue, because our revenue is based on the price times the quantity. Quick mention of corporate taxes. Things in terms of the corporate tax forecast are still relatively in line. You see here the last two May forecasts, or 2 years ago, the May forecast closed the session versus today, relatively the same concept that we would get down to a trend level. There isn't a ton of growth over time in these corporate taxes, because we predominantly tax profits of C corps in the current system, which are not expanding too rapidly over time, and so the outlook tends to try to land somewhere around $550 million a year or something along those lines, which we're just about to now. And the last recent data points look like we may be stabilizing along the lines of what our outlook is. So qualitatively, the outlook is the same. Quantitatively, unfortunately not. You see there is space there between the red and the blue lines, which means we did underestimate corporate tax revenues for the current biennium. So as with the personal income tax revenues, that has exceeded the 2% kicker threshold. In this case, generating for now what we estimate to be a $76 million corporate tax kicker. But unlike the personal tax kicker that gets returned to taxpayers, the corporate tax kicker will be distributed in terms of additional K-12 education spending. So, again, we're really trying to reconcile in this outlook a slowing economy in recent months with a pretty darn good April. And to what extent does this April reflect increased revenue earning potential going forward, and to what extent is it just about the timing of when tax payments come in? And where we ended up landing on this is about half is real and half is Memorex, or half is timing. And why is half real? The biggest factor would be business income or pass-through income on personal income tax records. This has been outstripping our forecast for several years running now. Here we see Schedule E type income, rents, partnerships, and S-corps, and also sole proprietorships in Oregon. And with our preliminary 2016 numbers, we have yet another year of increase. And so, as you see here for the Schedule E stuff, it's significantly ahead of where we were at the peak of the last business cycle. So we definitely have a larger cohort of Oregonians paying taxes on with these pass-through entities in terms of our collections. So that's good news, and increasing the outlook for these going forward. In the past, I guess it was a lot of, oh, it's going to come back down to earth, and some of it will. A lot of this growth is being fueled, we know, by housing-related industries. A lot of folks who are either developers, flippers, landlords, the like, use these sort of entities, and they've been seeing a lot of growth. Our colleagues at the City of Portland, Monona County, have seen similar things with they track, and they have a better handle on what sorts of businesses are paying it. And it does seem like a lot of this is real estate. Some of that will certainly come down to earth, but a lot of it is permanent, I think. And so we've added some of this to the outlook, which goes towards muting the impact of the kicker on the next biennium in terms of the available resources that you all have as you finish your job here in the coming months. So what are those changes? Here's 15-17, and our big April has seen net available resources going up by $370 million in April. The good thing about that, even though we have to pay it out in a kicker, is that that's there. So we do have those balances that have accumulated. So those can get shifted into the next budget period at the will of the legislature. So along with some expenditure savings on the expenditure side, we're looking at $376 million in additional ending balances that could be applied to the next year, given that the year-end tax payments were far outstripped our expectations. So with these balances, the overall picture for the next biennium is not too bad. You know, almost, you know, $180-190 million in additional resources. So this is we have a couple factors here. We have we're pushing forward these resources, but we're not, and which are kind of offset by the kicker that's coming out of this stream in the next biennium. But then we've added on top of that additional revenue growth, largely, again, because of these paths through entities. And so with that additional growth, we do see somewhat higher combined resources for the next biennium. So it will reduce the structural gap a little bit going forward into the next biennium. But being in the seats that we're in, it's important to mention that there's more to it than just the structural budget gap going forward is a bigger issue. I wouldn't want additional funds here, additional resources, even though they're small here, to take any of the momentum away from tax reform, given that it's still important. In addition to this structural budget issue that the legislature is dealing with, that is that trying the cost of doing what we're doing today is going up faster than our baseline revenues with an aging economy. You know, that's the structural problem, but there's always lurking in the background of our world the cyclical problem as well. That one of these years we're going to have a recession, and it'll blow a hole most likely larger than the structural one we're facing now. So with that in mind, there are a few more resources for the next biennium should this come to pass. So trying to abstract this next chart, looking at the forecast changes, gets away from this shifting of the additional balances that we have in this biennium to get you kind of the underlying what's happening in terms of, you know, the economic impacts on the forecast. And so in which case it's a little bit more of a steady story. We start out with high personal income tax collections, and if not for the impact of the kicker, you would have this smooth transition down there to losses in the out years. The small reduction we did in the employment forecast does impact revenues, and over time, those small changes in employment and wages compound and become bigger and bigger, to the point where we have $200 million subtraction in the 23-25 biennium. Of course, $200 million is less of a share of overall revenues than it is now. But nevertheless, there's an increasing drag created by this lower employment forecast. But in the near term, we do have some added growth. And as you see here, the 17-19 biennium, personal income taxes are expected to be down by about, on net, by about $246 million. That $246 million being less than the $400 million kicker that we've subtracted here, again, because we have put in some additional revenue growth in with this pass-through income. So that's what it would look like in absence of the additional resources that are created by the ending balance. So that missing tooth there translates into a missing tooth in our overall biennial revenue growth. As you've seen here, we've had three pretty good biennia in a row now at 15% year-over-year gains. Last biennium would be even stronger. It would have been a good old traditional biennium if not for the subtraction of the kicker in that biennium as well. So in terms of growth rates, though, that does create a bit of a swing, but again, overall resources are relatively unchanged as we go into the out years. But again, just like with employment, we can't expect to maintain the same sort of growth rates that we've become accustomed to in the past as the baby boom population cohort enters into their retirement years. And that's reflected here in around 10% and less growth rates going forward. Well, the flip side of that missing tooth you find over here on in the budgetary reserves. Pretty dramatic what that large ending balance does to our reserves at the end of this biennium, where we might be all the way up to a record $1.5 billion set aside this time, which is very encouraging. This is, however, where it does point out to the state economist the difficulties with the kicker law here. In the world, if I were in a different state, we would get to keep this reserve as well as, in addition to the revenue growth that we're seeing below. So here, we typically, in a typical state, we see a lot of folks, the biases certainly aren't, the forecast errors certainly aren't normally distributed. Most states intentionally lowball the revenue estimates. It's much easier for them to show up in front of their legislature with extra money than with not enough. I am jealous in terms of, what it does to the state budget and the volatility and whatnot, but it does, there is a nice silver lining to the kicker law insofar as it really does police our office to come up with our best guess. We're not managing for the legislature how much they need to save. We're just trying to come up with our most unbiased best guess of revenues, whether it be high or low. And so that's what this was. And with that, that's all the prepared comments that we have. But, of course, as always, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you for your note to put the brakes on tax reform just because of the rosy forecast. We always use that story about the old man with the leaky roof who doesn't fix the leak in the winter because it's raining and doesn't fix it in the summer because it isn't leaking. And that's always kind of been the story of tax reform in this state. So we're going to keep pushing forward. We have time for only one or two questions before we go to our joint committee at 9:30. So Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed several times in your presentation you talked about demographics and an aging population. I think we know that spending kind of drives the economy, and our highest spending years seem to be in our early 50s. Do you use that in when you looking out a decade or two decades from now, how that will work into your projections?
Yes, Chair Hass. Yes, we do. For us, it's not as important as the peak working age population. Not only are people spending the most in their midlife years, if that's a good word for that age range, but they're also earning the most. And for us as an income tax state, that's a big deal. Now, for the sales tax states, the aging of the population is very important because sales tax states depend heavily not just on spending in general, but spending on big ticket durable goods like cars and home furnishings, electronics, and stuff that maybe the aging baby boomer already has, as opposed to your root setting years and the like. Whereas, your aging households might be spending more on things that aren't subject to tax, like medical care or pharmaceuticals or food at home and things like that. And so that is a big issue. Sales tax states have seen this very steady erosion over the last 20 years in terms of the amount of revenue they get for, every dollar of economic output. And even far more than income tax states have.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many times in your presentation today, you've used terms like slowdown in economic activity or the term slowdown. And I think in every instance, or very nearly every instance, what you really meant was slowdown in the growth rate. Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, Chair Haas. Yes, thank you so much for clarifying that. Oregon's economy is bigger than ever and getting bigger by the day. And so that's what it feels like. That's what it feels like on the roads for sure. And that is true. What we're just talking about, slowdown in the growth rate, the rate of change or the rate of those increases being more like what we're seeing in other states.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the reason I raised the question at all is because somebody who was only half listening might think that the economy was in recession, but it isn't, is it? It's the other way around.
Absolutely not. And at the U.S. level, we're not seeing any sort of slowdown like we are here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be short. All the economists that work for the government sitting in the room for the last 12 years have lectured us that Oregon is the first in and the last out. And unless I missed something, your presentation just said, beware, we could be the first in and the last out. Am I missing something here?
Well, Senator Boquist, I don't want to get into too long of a, and Chair Haas, I don't want to get into too long of an explanation. That is a myth that Oregon is first in, first out. Sometimes we get that in the real-time data, and that's why we feel it. Because a lot of times the real-time data, the unrevised data, which we do a Herculean effort of trying to predict these revisions, that really does often lead or first in, first out. But if you look at the typical business cycle, and if we had more history, you'd see the past was the same. But it's pretty darn well coordinated with the U.S. in terms of these turning points in Oregon's job market. After they go back and revise the data, it looks like we're doing the same things as the U.S. And so that's one of the challenges. My predecessor, Dr. Pitalski, was up here going into a recession, and according to the Employment Department, they'd seen 4 or 5 consecutive months of good, decent job gains. And when those got revised, you know, he was here for a May forecast, a couple weeks later, those were revised, and oh no, actually, we've been losing jobs for 2 or 3 months before you put your close of session forecast out. And so this is something we're very sensitive to. But once the dust settles, we're really kind of coordinated in terms of the timing of our business cycles. The problem is they're just a lot wider. We boom a lot more and we bust a lot more. But the timing seems to be pretty much on track.
Bust a lot more.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Good job, as usual. All right. The Senate Committee on Revenue will adjourn. And if you need to pause, okay, but I don't need to open up the Joint Committee. The Joint Committee.